do it down on the house side in the middle?
The authority to do it.
Folks, we're live.
I can't go there.
Okay.
I'm sorry, see again. And what time?
A quick, short answer with a lot of people around me where I can't focus on.
Okay, we'll focus.
We'll listen to you.
We'll call the Senate Committee on Healthcare, Human Services, and Rural Health Policy Subcommittee of Healthcare Reform to order. And we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 99.
Representative Kettimer, hello.
We have two tasks before us, Rocky King and is Nora coming? Nora, okay. I didn't know just who was going to be testifying. To give us a little bit more of an overview, a little greater depth of understanding, and then we will have public testimony. And I don't know if we have the sign-up sheet, but we encourage those of you that would like to make comments and testify to do that this afternoon. We're fast running into the time when we will be essentially moving into work sessions as this bill begins to take shape. So this afternoon is the time to have that public testimony. Rocky, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I am Rocky King. I'm the interim director of health programs. And Nora, is that going
to... I'm Nora Leibowitz, development director for the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange.
So, Mr. Chair, what I'd like to do is kind of set the framework a little bit, because this the presentation we're about to give was actually developed for a week ago, and it was postponed because of the public testimony. And a lot has happened in this last week. As you well know, we have over 100 proposed amendments that have been submitted and continuing to kind of leak into us that we're trying to sort through and to put together in a readable and decision-making fashion for members of the committee, hopefully for next week, working through this weekend to get that accomplished. In addition, we've had some just really, I think, great conversations with a lot of the representatives from the carrier community to try to distill from them some of the similarities and some of the positions relative to the amendments, but also to begin to highlight some of the differences that and different perspectives that some of the stakeholders and carriers have. So that hasn't been kind of bled into this presentation today, so we might highlight those as we go through, and you can stop and ask me, obviously, questions anytime you want. I just wanted to take the first slide and talk about just kind of the what we call an environmental scan, and just to kind of remind everybody what we're really looking at in a what we call a changing market in 2014. I want to remind everybody that all coverage is going to be guaranteed issue. That includes individual, small group, as well as large group coverage. There will be no pre-existing condition periods or exclusions. There is an individual insurance requirement. Some people call that a mandate. However you want to reference it, but it isn't contained in the federal law. There are rate bands and rating rules for the individual and small group markets that are somewhat different than we have today. And a rate band is basically that the lowest rate that you charge an individual coming into the market, and for I think it's 3-to-1 age band, means that the highest rate you can charge is three times that amount. So $100 is your lowest rate, $300 is your highest rate. That will have some impact on the market, where, for example, in the individual market today, we're generally between about 5.5-to-1, so you're going to see some compression in the market. Each one of these is going to have an impact on the stability of not only Oregon's markets, but the insurance markets on a national basis that we're going to have to plan for. There's changing the small group market from 2 to 50 to 1 to 50 in 2014, and that expands to 1 to 1,000 in 2016. In one piece that I'll talk about later, this bill does not purport to change the Oregon statutes or to jump ahead of the federal government, and we are going to keep, we think, right now, the 2014 1 to 50 and the 1 to 100 in 2016. To change that would require legislative action in the insurance code, not through the exchange bill. We have a tremendous expansion of Medicaid eligibility that's anticipated up to approximately 138% of the federal poverty level. Obviously, we're here and talking about the health insurance exchange, and a key decision point is whether you want the federal government to run it or whether you want the state option, which is to design and develop and run our own. The absence of us taking the initiative and setting up ours, the federal government will run it. Very similar to the high-risk pools. You know, part of the reform in 2010 or 2009 was to establish a federal high-risk pool. And every state had the election of whether to run that pool themselves or for the federal government to come in and run it. Oregon elected to run the federal high-risk pool, and they basically brought that into our regular state high-risk pool. Some states chose not to do that and let the federal government design the federal high-risk pool. We have the same issue with the exchange. The difference is in terms of magnitude. In the case of the federal high-risk pool, Oregon has 300 or 400 people in it. In the case of an exchange, you're talking about 350,000. But it's the same kind of decision point. I'll talk a little later about risk pooling and some of the concerns about selection issues inside and outside the exchange and what some of the federal strategies and one of the state strategies that actually the full committee took last week to address some of the risk adverse selection in these with some of these changes. We'll talk about the essential benefits to be offered for cost levels in the exchange. And also, what we haven't talked about is that federal law allows for a catastrophic plan option for young adults and for those not subject to the mandate.
Mr. Chair, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rocky, at some point, could you break down, I mean, there's a lot of federal stuff in there, but some of it is in the federal legislation and some of it is in the planning components that have yet to be developed. Could you kind of parse that out for us at some point? I mean, when you're talking about the cost levels, they haven't determined that yet. I mean, those sorts of things as opposed to risk and things like
that. Mr. Chair, Santa Cruz, I can do that just simply by I'll place some X's on a piece of paper and give to you. And a good example of that is risk pooling. We know that that's undefined. Guaranteed issue, it's there. That's pretty easy to do, and I'll do that for the committee.
Thank you.
Nora, would you like to take this piece?
So one of those pieces is the issue of essential benefits, and I know that's been an interest of a lot of folks about what the essential benefits are really going to look like. The work that's happening at the federal level on the essential benefits, there's a report that's due out from the Institute of Medicine in the fall with the regs to come out at the end of the year. And certainly from the state level, we are very enthusiastically awaiting the benefits, because a lot of the questions that come up about what Oregon's current requirements are, what the mandates are in the state, and how that would look compared to whether our mandates are higher or lower than the essential benefits package, we really won't know for sure, at least until the fall when the recommendations come out, and then in the end of the year. There's also the question about qualified health plan minimum standards. To the state, in the federal law, the states are given the authority to make decisions about the what plans are enrolled based on establishing standards, but those standards are to be based on a set of federal standards, minimum standards for qualified health plans. And again, that's another piece that the federal government is working on. I was actually on a call today in which there were some questions for our federal partners about when we can expect to see those, and it seems like in a few months is sort of the best answer at this point, that they're hoping to have some regs out in draft in the next few months. Do you want to add something?
The only thing I would like to add, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and I'm not sure if we get to it later here, but there's a difference between carrier participation and qualified plans and what the exchange can offer. and we'll make this clear, and we hopefully in the amendments that have been proposed and the discussions we've had with a number of carriers, it is the intent that any carrier can participate in the exchange as long as they're licensed and in good standing with the regulatory agency, the insurance division in the state. So there is no intent to exclude standards that would exclude a carrier. That's different than the qualified health plan. So Carrier X can offer the qualified health plans. If those plans meet the requirements as established by the board, then they will be able to participate. So there is no carrier you need to meet these qualifications, you know, that the exchange is set up in order to submit your plans. The carrier, as long as they're licensed, doing business, you know, solvent, all that good stuff that the insurance division does, then is automatically eligible to submit to the exchange the qualified plans as defined by the federal standards and any additional ones that the state determines. But I think that's a key point, because a lot of people thought that they were going to set standards for the excluded carriers, and that's not the case. It's really the plans that the focus is going to be on.
Thank you. And then the third piece that's really a federal HHS issue is coordination with the Medicaid program. And in the discussions that we've been having with our federal partners, they have been really clear that they are working very hard to make changes to the Medicaid program. Currently, there are a lot of rules that could be described somewhat as archaic about categories of eligibility, and they recognize that those aren't necessarily so useful in determining eligibility, because it really is going to be about, you know, do you meet the financial limits to be Medicaid eligible, or are you eligible for tax credits? And so they're also working on changes to the Medicaid rules that will really help streamline our work. And again, we're anxiously awaiting for those changes to happen. So that's kind of the... So they're also, we thought it might be useful to have some discussion about what Rocky and I do when we're not here with you.
When aren't you
well,
with
no,
us?
We certainly enjoy our time talking with you all, but we want you to know that we are working diligently along with our staff to work on the development of the actual details of an exchange. And as you may know, starting last September, we received a planning grant from our federal partners, and we, as part of that, laid out a number of pieces of work that we were engaging in, and that includes doing a resource and needs assessment to get a sense of where are we now in the state, what resources do we have, where are the gaps, what pieces of state work can be used for the future exchange, where do we need to build capacity, as well as, once we had made those identifications, building a business operations plan. And that really is, you know, what kind of people does the exchange need to have? What kind, based on the kind of overall functions that we've talked about when we've come here, it's the idea of if the exchange needs to qualify health plans, who needs to be involved with that? What level of skill do they have, and what resources do they need, and what information are they going to need, so that we have a sufficient team to conduct the work and make sure that we are accessing the resources that do exist in the state. We're also working on the technical infrastructure side. It's a fairly large project to do eligibility and enrollment processing, moving that eligibility work on the Medicaid side that's been happening in a paper-heavy way so far, moving that into a real-time, online, and, dare I say, user-friendly Medicaid eligibility and enrollment process, because the federal law does require us to do eligibility determination and enrollment both for Medicaid and for the exchange commercial side. So we're essentially, the way that it's been described is that we're modernizing the Medicaid eligibility process at the same time that we're developing the exchange eligibility process and enrollment process. So it really is, it's not just about the user experience, but having that user experience of shopping for plans and figuring out what you're eligible for and enrolling easily, having that be tied to this back-end processing that the user won't see, but that makes sure that we're getting correct information about income and providing the right information about health plans, and that all of that back-end stuff that, that should be not visible to the user is happening seamlessly, and that we're connecting between the Medicaid program and the federal government where we need to get information from them and the plans as well.
Before you leave that, Nora, if I may, Mr. Chair, this you brought up an issue, I think, in a previous meeting, and it's the business operations plan. We just had a meeting with them earlier this week where we are really laying out the options of what do you build versus what do you purchase, what do you outsource, for example, what you do inside. And it's that plan, which will hopefully be done over the next 3 to 4 months, that will have a variety of options. The other piece I think it's important is the pieces you see here really are to be set up for a handoff to the public corporation. Some of the work we will start, but once the corporation's kind of set up, the state really hands this off to them. So it isn't something that Oregon Health Authority will be doing for the next 2 years. It's really kick-starting the process. But it gets to the what will we buy inside, outside, how do we do that, what are the pieces that the exchange can do to keep it lean and mean, what's more appropriate to have somebody else do versus the exchange. And an example of that is you're going to have appeals. One of the charges against for the exchange is to make a decision on the appeals of individuals that are subject to the mandate, and if they've been told you have to buy health insurance and they feel that that decision is wrong, they fall into those categories that aren't required to buy health insurance, the appeal process is through the exchange. That wouldn't be outsourced. That's something the exchange would do. On the other hand, there may be many of the IT functions, obviously, that the management of those or development, we're not going to try to do those in-house. That will be done through an outsourcing piece. Again, I don't want to prejudge what a public corporation board's going to decide, but I think that's the general flavor of the direction the consultants will probably lay out in terms of their planning.
And obviously part of the operations planning is a finance plan to figure out what this is going to cost and how a lot of the discussion around what are the recommended strategies for paying for the exchange on an ongoing basis once the federal financing goes away in 2015. So that's also part of what's happening over this few-month period. In addition, Oregon applied for, at the end of last year, an IT Innovator Grant. The federal government was put out what they're calling cooperative agreements, where they were asking for states to make applications saying that they were prepared to develop the IT systems for the exchange, and that these states would then be used as models for other states, that we would share the intellectual products of that work in order to help other states that are maybe not as far along in their thinking. And as I said, because we're in a stage where we're moving from a paper process to an electronic process for the Medicaid eligibility, that we basically told the federal government that we see ourselves as a model for states that want to make that transition, because there are a number of states that have that are still in this in the paper processing of eligibility applications and that seek to come into this more modern, real-time, easier to use process. So the grant that we were awarded, that's currently waiting for Ways and Means approval, was for $48.1 million for a two-year grant period. And it's a very aggressive timeline. It's a lot of work to happen in a two-year period, but we have quite a good team established through the current DHS and OHA IT staff.
Excuse me, Nora. What are the release points on that $48 million?
When do we get the money?
Yes.
Well, once we get approval from Ways and Means, we have four what they call gate reviews, and they are set up to say, okay, what's your do you have your plan structure set up, what are your implementation, and they do these four check-ins. The first one is supposed to happen later this month, so they're tied to the gate reviews.
And those gate reviews, explain how it would relate to final appropriations. We pass the bill and you have appropriations. How do those gate reviews relate to that?
They are asking for us to say, okay, if we're going to contract for, the idea is that we will contract for a what they call commercial off-the-shelf product, so that we're not just building something all on our own, but that the software will be purchased and we have some sense of what that software is going to be purchased. And when they see our plan, our procurement plan is set, and they give us that approval, then we can use the money to actually purchase the software.
Thank you. Yes.
Just a question on that. We had eHealth come and give a presentation, and I know they must charge commission. And I was just curious, what's about the going rate on commissions from something like that?
Well, Ms. Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, there's really two aspects, I think, to eHealth. One is the infrastructure charge, which may be 1 or 2% or 3%, I don't know, they can respond to that. But eHealth also is a electronic broker, which means that they can earn a commission from the carrier that they end up, if somebody comes in and enrolls on a plan, they actually get a commission from the carrier on that too. So I don't know the details, but maybe you can have them respond to that.
Just a quick response. I asked that question to them, and they're 7%. But they work as a broker, so that's a pretty standard fee.
You mean what?
7% of premium.
Of premium.
Yeah.
Of the whole premium, month after month.
Month after month? Premium.
Oh, it's a monthly premium, as I understood. It was the normal charge that most brokers charge is 5 to 7%, maybe a little less, a little more. Their charge is 7%. That's what they quoted to me.
And we said that our agents got 3% commission?
I think they get more than that, really. More.
Okay. Okay. Just curious.
Mr. Chair. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
We can get the answer.
We can flesh that out later. I have some questions concerning the grant. And you've explained some of the grant, which I appreciate. The grant is primarily, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, to set up RV, probably a request for proposal to outline what you're looking for and to set the mechanism in place to start shopping, looking for, and potentially implementing an off-the-shelf product to handle the exchange. Is that correct?
Yes. We have not selected any vendors. It would the next step is, when we have approval, is to start the an RFP process to get there's sort of multiple components that no one does all of it. So there's the software piece. Mm-hmm. There's what they call in IT jargon a system integrator, which I've finally understood means that they take the software that's the out-of-the-box software and make it work for what we need. We give them all of our business rules and they help write the code to make it work for us. And then that attaches to the user interface, and the eHealth and others like that are the user interface end. So it is sort of three pieces.
Follow-up? In a vastly smaller scale, I've gone through this process, and usually you purchase a program and then have a monthly fee thereafter, or annual, semi-annual fee, usually a monthly fee. Sometimes it's based on the amount of work going through it, sometimes it's a flat fee. Can some of this money be used to purchase, once you've done the RFP and selected a product and have integrated the product, can some of this money be used to actually make the purchase for the state and then the state support it through the exchange as far as a monthly fee or whatever system is set up?
Yeah. Ms. Chair, Senator Bates, I think that gets to some of the business plan. There are pieces that the state may want to, because of the Medicaid portion of this, the state may want to run. You may have some of it outsourced. The exchange may have a little piece of it. I doubt that. The skills are really in different places, but those are the kinds of decisions that will be made. The other piece, and I think it's really hard, I mean, we've been through presentations with eHealth, both in front of you, but but also privately. There are a whole bunch of vendors, folks, that have been meeting with us, that have been trying to show us their expertise, the different ideas, and each one gives us some ideas, and everyone brings a little bit something different to the table, different focus, different expertise. That's the reason we go through a procurement process, is so that everybody gets to lay what kind of their offer is on the table, and we hope that we'll be able to do that in the near future.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. I'm hoping that if we do accept this grant at $48 million, we get more out of it than just we picked a system with it. I hope we get a lot more than that, and that some of the upfront costs the state would have for setting this program up are absorbed through that. Having said that, I'm a little concerned about how time-sensitive this grant is. In the back of my mind is that assuming no federal changes, which could change, but are likely or unlikely, depending on your position and thoughts, but I'll make the assumption there's no change. We have a time-sensitive situation here. We've got about 18 months to put this thing together and get it up and running, and at that point, the feds come in and set one up for us. I much prefer us doing that than the feds doing that. And so if we lose this grant because we don't act on it, I have some concerns about that. What's our time sequence for having to accept this grant? Do you know the answer to that? I mean, we have a certain length of time. We have to say yes or no, or it goes to another state. So do we have any idea what that looks like?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, I'm going to let Nora talk about the grant, but I want to get to the dates that you mentioned because I think you made a good point. We all think about January 1 of 2014, long time away. The reality is, though, to really start enrolling people, you've got to start putting people into the system probably September and October of 2013. In order to put people in the system, you've got to have it tested and working. The federal government is going to certify whether we're ready to go in January of 2013, and that's the 18 months that you're really talking about. So it isn't like we have 28 months. We really have about 18 months to get this up and for them to be able to say, you know, it's going to work, we're going to go with you. The reason that date's so early is if they decide or we decide we're not ready to go, then they've got to have lead time, and they're already starting to develop their, you know, for those states probably that aren't going to do this, their infrastructure from a federal level, but they have to have lead time to put it in place here too. So I'll let Nora talk specifically about the grant timing.
Excuse me, we have, I think, two questions. Riverson Kenner, you okay?
No, I'm fine. Thank you. I'll hold off and let him keep going.
Okay. So. Good.
Okay. Chair Morrison, Senator Bates, just to respond to the issue of the timing, we did include in our response that we would have an expedited procurement process that would be over a 3-month period. So I'm not particularly concerned if we're spending, you know, some amount of time going through the due diligence that we need to do for Ways and Means. But obviously, a significant delay does, given Rocky's description of our timing, have an impact. And I feel confident in that we have good relationships with the funders. And I think that as long as we're able to work with them to say, okay, here's where we are, and let them know that we can still meet our overall deadlines, I feel confident about it. I think we need to make sure as we go forward that we are still able to meet all those time frames before we commit to the project. So,
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Did you hear an answer in there?
Because
if you did, I missed it. Okay.
Senator Bates, my answer is that we've said that we'll have a 3-month procurement process, that they've said that's what they want to hear, and I'm saying that the process we're in now with Ways and Means, as long as it's not itself a three-month process, should allow us to meet those deadlines.
Mr. Chair, if we wait 6, 7, 8 weeks, you'd have a month and a half to do the procurement process.
Right.
That's probably not going to work for you.
Yeah.
What would you think is a reasonable time for to have a procurement process that would satisfy you and the feds?
Well, I'm hesitant to say. I'm hesitant to say that. I think, yeah, the procurement process itself needs to have 90 days. A usual procurement process is, I'm sure you know, that's fast for that. But working with Department of Justice, we've said, you know, they're confident that we can use this special procurement process, and that'll be fine. I'm hesitant to say if we don't have approval by X date, all is lost, because I think part of what we're doing now is figuring out, okay, what happens if we don't have approval by a certain date? How does that affect our timing? And working with the federal partners to make sure that we can change our dates in a way that still works for them.
What are you buying on this short timeline?
I'm sorry?
What are we buying on this very compressed short timeline? When you say procurement process, you're procuring something. What is that?
Chair Morse, we are procuring the software piece and then ultimately what they call the system integrator, the IT people who will make that piece of software work for our business needs.
And that has to be done in what time frame?
The software piece has to be done in 3 months.
Before we even... Yeah, this is troublesome.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I think you're where I am. I was sitting here listening to this. That's why I was happy when Senator Bates was digging. I've been involved in a lot of software, SAP, JD Edwards, Maximo, whichever ones, just for the financial side. And if we're going to rush buying something in 3 months, we could be on the front page of the paper, just like the city of Portland was with their water billing software and things like that. And we're going to be much bigger because we're $48 million rather than $1 million. I see a disaster waiting to happen if we rush this thing like this.
Chair Morse and Representative Widener, I want to clarify that the work that's been going on the Medicaid side has been fairly extensive. They conducted a vendor fair. They did an RFI process. So they have done significant evaluation of the potential vendors in this software realm. And so we're not starting from square one in the 90-day process. What we've done is significant scoping, and with the vendors that have been identified as able to meet the needs for the eligibility and enrollment piece, we're currently engaging in more data collection with them on their ability to meet the exchange piece as well. So I agree that if we were starting from square one, that would be quite ambitious.
What we need is a map with timelines and activities, and so that would resolve a lot of this.
Mr. Chair, I want to refer you back to the exchange business plan. We can't start kind of the exchange pieces of this until some of that business plan has been laid out. If you'll notice, one of those is the technical infrastructure, and it really is that work plan that you're talking about and giving the kind of the details and the milestones for that. It is above my pay grade. When I sit down with these IT folks, and these are smart people, whether it's people representing eHealth or one of the other five or six vendors, these folks are pretty good at what they do, and the consultants that are helping us lay out this process are not people that are bidding on this, but are from the IT world, I guarantee you. And so we will have that project plan. I can show you as kind of the opening kind of project plans that we've been doing that.
And we do have, just to be clear, for what we submitted to the federal government, we do have a work plan for that with timelines. We're happy to share that as well.
We can share that.
Mr. Chair, along these lines, we've been through this once before in a program that looks like it's going to work for a change. That's the prescription monitoring bill. And essentially what happened is LFO got involved with the administration, and I think he essentially hired a broker. There's brokers out there now who you do not buy the hardware or software from. They are experts in looking at hardware and software. They work directly for you. They don't work for the hardware software people. And those brokers are really good at resolving these issues, laying out timelines and business plan to make sure you get your best value, because they're not trying to sell you something. They're an intermediate in between. And I know several of the managed care plans that have used them and done very well with programs that work for them now. And those that tried to go directly to a vendor, because it's so technical, many of them got in trouble that way. So I'll make an assumption here. You're probably talking to brokers, not the vendors themselves, because that's a smart way to do it now in this world.
And Ms. Chair, Representative Widener's kind of comment. In sitting down with the IT people, it's absolutely fascinating. It's not just what's a little piece of software that you can buy to go do this. It's what kind of management expertise do you need to not only make the decisions what to buy, but to run it, and who should run it? Should it be managed on the state level, or do you really bring in somebody different or contract with somebody different to manage it? Somebody pointed out that the exchange, not e-health, that's kind of, I mean, we got a lot of e-healths out there. John Gridley in Southern Oregon, if anybody's in your district, great website for stuff, and does multi-state. There are a lot of websites out there for buying and selling insurance. But the issue when you start integrating with the Medicaid program and the subsidies and all the pieces to it, it's extremely complicated. And it was quoted to me that we're almost 5 to 7 generations ahead in terms of technology than what most states are at. And it gets to your issue, Representative, which is we've got to figure out the best management structure of that. It's not Rocky that's going to manage it. I don't have the skills or the expertise. That is as big a challenge as what software, what integrator do we want to use? So I don't want to make light of the difficulty or the challenges we have of this task, or to make you assume that the expertise is sitting in front of you, because it's not.
Well, it's a fine line in between the executive branch function to the design and delivery.
That's right.
And our responsibility to hold you accountable for performance.
Yep.
And so we'll blend those two together as we go along here. Please proceed.
Where are we here?
Quick mention of future funding. The federal government has announced that the funding for the implementation of the exchanges, we're currently under a planning grant. The future funding for the implementation piece will be available, and we will be, as Rocky and I mentioned, using the work from the planning grant, the resources and needs assessment, et cetera, the business plans, we'll then use those plans to apply for the funds from the federal government to do the actual implementation work. And the federal government has laid out in quite a bit of detail the milestones that they want to see in a variety of what they call core areas, including the IT piece, but also eligibility and enrollment and working with stakeholders and addressing where agents come in and sort of all of these pieces that have come up in the various discussions. They're asking so that the work based on having the legislation and having the operations planning will allow us to then apply for the implementation funds.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. Currently, the federal government is funding itself 2 weeks at a time. So where's the security that funding actually exists or will exist?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, that's a question I can't. That's, you're directing it. I wouldn't have the foggiest idea what is going to happen to the federal budget over the coming years. That said, I think that it's like all of the legislation. If it becomes a halt to it, we have to halt. It's a reality.
Mr. Chair, I guess the point I'm after is that there's no certainty in D.C. for anything at this point in time, and I question building too big of a bridge to nowhere, when ultimately maybe it all falls back to us and what we can do. So,
members of the committee, we're on the next slide, 5th slide. A couple things that I think are really important. In a lot of the discussions we've had with carriers and with yourselves, is that we want to make sure it's understanding that the exchange is not the regulator. DCBS, the insurance division, is the regulator of the markets. To the degree that the 99-1 is unclear, you'll see some amendments that I think make sure to say the exchange will not be regulating the market. Licensing, rate regulation, all of that will remain at DCBS.
Mr. Chair?
Yep.
Yes.
Can I explore that a little bit?
Sure. You mean it's not because you decided not to put in this bill, or it's not because God created them as the regulator, or...
Senator Morris, Representative Greenlick, you could, from a policy perspective, make a decision to move regulation out of DCBS into the health authority or to the exchange. What my understanding is from the governor's office and from my bosses is that is not the intent from a policy perspective at this point as it relates to this legislation.
Is that one of the amendments you just said? Because I'd very much like to do that. I think DCBS is not doing the job on health insurance regulation. And I think if we have an exchange that's somehow independent of DCBS, it just doesn't make any sense. I think the exchange has to be the regulator. And if we need to make sure we have amendments to make that happen, I would argue very strongly for that to happen.
Senator Morris, Representative Greenlick, I think that's a policy decision for you
exactly.
Folks to work out.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm of a mixed mind on this. What I'm concerned about is we're going to have insurers outside the exchange, insurers inside the exchange. Those will be probably the same companies with different potential plans. One plan for inside the exchange, one outside, or various plans in there with the same companies. Regulations from outside, regulations from inside make this a more complex deal and very difficult for those companies. Not that I'm defending the companies or taking a side here, but it makes me concerned. If DCBS isn't doing their job, which I think I have some agreement with Representative Mitch and I would probably agree on, I think you need to fix DCBS, not just try to fix them inside the exchange. It's a broader picture from my point of view. If they're not regulating properly, then we need to get the whole picture taken care of, not just inside the exchange.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, kind of in a difficult position here, but I would probably take issue on a personal basis, I guess, with DCBS not doing their job. I think they do a good job, and I'd be happy to meet with Representative Greenlick. I know rate review is a...
That may have been a slightly strong statement, which I've been known to do in the
past. Let's say they could have...
And they let me back
areas,
a little off
certain
that.
Certain areas I think they can improve, okay?
Thank you. But, I appreciate
I
a lot.
I want Mrs. Miller in here beating me on the head in 2 seconds.
I know Ms. Miller very well, and she strives very, very hard to make sure that we have a fair and equitable market and a competitive market, and I know that's an issue before a variety of committees. But that said, decisions around dual market or a single market, we're not proposing a single market. We're really saying it's going to be a dual market, and in order to change that, that would take a change to our insurance code. We're not proposing that. So that I think it's just important that in the absence of any policy decision on the part of the legislature, there is a regulatory agency, and then there's the exchange, and they are two different ones. Nora, you want to do this or me? I'm not... Go ahead.
Well, the other thing that we wanted to clarify is that participation in the exchange is voluntary, that that individuals or small businesses that that want to use the exchange are free to do that. There will be minimum standards that the federal government is setting that are used as the basis of the exchange offerings, and our anticipation is that the exchange will work with the health plans to refine the participation requirements, seeing that that working with the plans to work through some of these issues has been historically a useful way to kind of get a sense of what plans are able to do and where we can move. We can encourage them to move further in terms of quality and efficiency and related areas, particularly because the overall state goals of improving quality and containing costs are things that we see as ways that the exchange can have a benefit not just for the individual consumers and the plans they purchase, but for the for Oregon as a whole, that to the extent that we're encouraging changes at the plan level, that these are changes that could impact the whole market.
Mr. Chair,
Either Rocky or Nora, I don't, either one. The statements made by the President and Secretary Sebelius this week about the fact that the enhanced flexibility to states that was scheduled for 17 may all be on the board immediately or not, but maybe, is that changing the way you're looking at any of this or not?
We both have thoughts.
Both have thoughts. We haven't coordinated our answers on this, but let me give you my thoughts, and Nora will give you yours. Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, we have to put 350,000 folks into this exchange by 15 in order for it to be sustainable. This is a big challenge, especially when you look at that it has to be integrated with 500,000 Medicaid folks that are going to be coming in and out with a 50% churn and a whole bunch of changes to our market that are going to be difficult to maintain stability. For us to decide to make this bigger than it is at first creates, I think, some business risks that I'm not sure that we want to take. That said, the waiver flexibility that I think that the federal government is looking at may assist us around some of the transformational issues around the delivery system and some of the benefit pieces. So I think we're going to have to closely look at that. But right now, it is nothing more than a pronouncement without details. Until we get those details, it's hard to react. But my job in terms of my bosses and to you is to also say we have to measure the business risk as we go forward. And we're taking on an awful lot, and I want to make sure we do that in a careful, measured way before we head off into different directions. Nora?
That's actually reasonably consistent with what I was going to say, just that I think that the areas that we might look for flexibility are areas where I think we need to do some careful planning. So it is around the issue of businesses larger than 100. Do we want to move them in earlier or not? And thinking very carefully about the impact that that has on these other core groups of individuals and small businesses, as well as thinking about particularly for things like value-based benefits, if we have the ability to make sure that that's a plan offering, you know, not the only plan offering, but an offering within the exchange, depending on what the federal government says about their minimum standards. And then some thinking around the fact that for many families, there will be children enrolled in the Healthy Kids program, and the parents will be eligible for tax credits, and thinking about ways that we can coordinate coverage for families, because recognizing that when people have different systems that they're in, it's harder for them to negotiate. You know, if they can't go to the same clinic, or they can't see the same provider or whatever. So a lot of that is really at the level of what do we need to think about before we make decisions about where we want waivers.
We need to be sensitive to time.
Yeah,
this is a great discussion, but we do have public testimony that we need to allow time for. Rocky and Nora, maybe just hit the high points.
Okay. Mr. Chair, let me just talk about role of agents, if I may, for a minute. I think that we heard a lot of testimony from the agent community, and we will continue to have discussions with them in terms of how that role is going to be played in the exchange. Obviously, it's not a decision for me. It's a decision for the exchange and the agent community and the carriers going forward. But I hope that we really look at the OMIP and the FIAT models and how we've built on them, and you heard some testimony from some of the agents because it's worked very well in terms of appointing all agents so they're not just tied to one carrier. And secondly, looking at the ability to train those agents and certify them so they understand the program. So that I won't spend a lot of time on that, but it's really important. The other piece is the risk pieces that come out between when you come into an exchange. Are you going to get everybody that's just unhealthy? Where are the healthy going to go? There's going to be a lot of disruption around pricing. The federal government has established their intent to have the states run two of the risk mechanisms, and with the federal government operating one, what's designed for Mississippi may not work in Oregon. What's designed for New York may not work in Oregon. That's why I think we're really excited about the Children's Reinsurance Program to begin testing our own expertise and building the structure so that when we see what the feds come up with, we can make an analysis of whether that's good enough, and if not, what are the things we've learned in these 2 years prior to that. Ms. Chair, and really that's running through it real quick unless you had something, Nora, that we're anxious to hear the public testimony too, so we're ready to stand down.
Okay, thank you. I think one of the challenges, the biggest challenge, is we're trying to address a moving target, and we don't know what all of those requirements are. So how do we craft legislation that meets this kind of 90-day timeline things when we it's ill-defined at this point?
Mr. Chair, one of the things that I'd like to close with, because you'll hear this next week, is the public accountability. There's been a lot of discussion about legislative oversight and public accountability, and I think you're going to see some of the proposals that we're going to put on the table after discussions with the stakeholders that are going to ensure that there is ongoing legislative review and oversight as we move forward, not just in the planning, but in the implementation and the eventual operational phases. So you'll see that, I think, next week in some of the ideas that have been put forward, and which doesn't guarantee anything, but it guarantees a set of eyes that are important to have there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll call up Eileen Brady and Laura Etherton and Martin Taylor. Looks like we have six people to testify.
Good afternoon, Chair and Senator Montes-Anderson. I understand this is the subcommittee.
Yes.
Not the committee, and visitors to the subcommittee. For the record, my name is Eileen Brady. I'm a founding owner of New Seasons Market in Portland, Oregon, and I'm a chair and owner of the Celilo Group Media, which is known in Portland as the Chinook Book, which is basically the green entertainment guide to small business in Portland. I'm also on the Oregon Health Policy Board and have the institutional knowledge that comes with having been appointed to the Oregon Health Fund Board by none other than Senator Bates here, who took a leading role in getting me there. And I've always said that he told the biggest lie I ever heard. He said to me, "Don't worry, it's only going to be about 4 hours a month. It's a minimal commitment." And it was about 20 hours a week for a couple of years. At any rate, I have a couple of things to say, one in my capacity on the Health Policy Board and the other as a business owner. As on the Health Policy Board, one of the way I would frame this discussion is that this insurance exchange is one piece of a larger whole. We're all trying to get a hold of this cost containment issue. And this discussion of insurance exchanges predates, and in Oregon, all of the federal reform conversation. It's easier for me to understand it actually not thinking about the federal reform conversation and going back to where we were 3 years ago and saying that this is a key piece in how we're going to aggregate it's a key piece of how we're going to aggregate some of the purchasing power here. We have a market system. I'm a believer in markets. We have a market system that's broken. We have an industry where the more you do of something, the price goes up. You're not creating efficiencies. So the Health Policy Board has brought forth a set of programs to you folks to consider that have multiple pieces, one of which is this insurance exchange. So we can institute the federal version of this, or we can institute the Oregon version of it. The Oregon version is very well thought out, so I encourage you to get into the details. I'm happy to meet with any of you. I imagine they're going to ask me to come back and do some of that at some point in time. I think of this exchange as having it's basically a continuum. You can have an exchange that's a website, that makes it easier for individuals to access health insurance. We should do that. Everybody should do that. We should make it easier to get insurance. There should be some really reasonable choices for all individuals and small businesses to have. On the other end of the continuum, you can have a very highly managed insurance exchange. We've looked at the entire range. My opinion on this is that we want to have a somewhat of a more managed exchange. We want to be able to have not only easy access, but we want to be able to be a smart purchaser. We want to implement our delivery system changes that we believe we need to implement to really bring the true costs down, and the payment reform program that goes with that. So to me, the insurance exchange is one of several vehicles we're bringing forward that actually begins to reduce the costs in the entire system. As a business owner, what's very interesting to me is the amount of choice the actual consumers are going to end up with. So in the small business that I'm chair of, we have 25 individuals and we have one health insurance plan. And every year, it's very, very difficult. There is no human resource manager. It's very, very difficult to go through the renewal process, even trying to understand what is the plan, what's in the plan, what are the benefits of the plan. I don't want my business, that business, to have to worry about that anymore. And I want to be able to offer the employees more choices. So I see the insurance exchange just from a simple business equation. It's going to save money on the administrative side inside the business, and it's going to provide more choices to the employees. That piece, that's easy. That's a no-brainer for me. So I'm looking forward to the detailed conversation about how do we use all of these vehicles, including this exchange, as a smart purchaser. In all of these countries that we've looked at, I'm now, 3.5 years into my study, and I apparently still can't get an honorary degree in a Master's of Public Health from PSU. But I'm studying. I continue to study. The GDP for health care in most westernized countries is between 9 and 10%, and we're at 17%. There's a lot of room to give in the system and maintain a lot of choices. So I'm looking forward to implementing a few of these vehicles. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Eileen, I want to thank you for the hard work you've done for the last 3.5 years. I'll talk to Portland State University about your master's program.
Thank you, Senator Bates.
We all will.
And I just want to say one more thing. I don't know if you read the bill yet, but in Section 4, Line 16, it outlines who the Board of Directors will be. And it's a chairperson or a designee of the chairperson of the Oregon Health Policy Board. This will only take about 4 hours a month.
And I would say that I think that it's worth having the conversation on governance. I think that's an important conversation to have.
Mm-hmm. Getting aside, it is.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thank you. Chair Morris and members of the committee, my name is Laura Etherton. I'm the healthcare advocate at Osperg. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of creating a strong health insurance exchange here in Oregon, and offer our suggestions on how to make sure that Oregon's exchange is really effective in delivering lower costs, better quality, and better health for Oregonians. A little bit of background, Osperg actually works together with a coalition of organizations on supporting creating a strong exchange here in Oregon. And together we submitted last week a written letter going through a set of principles that we think are really important to evaluate any proposal on the exchange against those criteria. And there's a number of folks who also signed on to that letter who are here today. So I will try to keep my comments brief so that you can hear from them as well. We're excited about the potential for an exchange to pool the buying power of consumers and businesses that don't have very much power in the market right now, to pool that purchasing power, to be able to negotiate a better deal, to improve choices, and to actually implement some of the delivery system reforms that I think hold the promise of actually reducing the costs and slowing that cost trend rise. And as Eileen mentioned, this is a key approach to a multi-prong approach to fixing our broken healthcare system. It
alone will not do the trick, but we do believe it is a very key aspect to doing that. In the analysis of the Senate bill, the 99-1, that I'm including as the written testimony, I outlined about six different criteria areas that we look at in terms of the bill and what recommendations we would make to make the bill even better, and also comment on provisions in the bill that are especially good and that we're really excited about. I want to just outline several of those quickly for you today. First, we are very supportive of the bill's mission, the mission that the bill gives to the exchange. It connects the exchange with the triple aim of reducing costs, but not by cutting care, but by improving quality and improving overall population health for Oregonians over the course of their lifetimes. And also, the direction in the mission section of the bill for the exchange to be accountable to the public and to the consumers and the businesses that would obtain and buy through the exchange coverage for themselves and their families and their employees. Secondly, on accountability of the exchange and governance, we support the creation of a board to oversee the exchange, but we are concerned about the fact that the bill allows for some measure of conflicts of interest on that board. We recommend overall that a majority of members of the board be representatives from the consumer and business communities across the state, and that specifically we'd recommend the bill be amended to be clear that no one on the board should have a conflict of interest. The bill currently allows two seats to be exempt from the conflict of interest requirements, and we think that not only will lead to problems with the consumers and businesses in the state trusting the exchange, but also some concerns about whether, for example, an insurance company representative could effectively serve on a board where its businesses' interests may be in conflict with the mission of that board and actually negotiating a better deal for consumers and businesses.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
May I explore that for just
sure,
a moment?
Sure.
There isn't a conflict of interest statement, incidentally. It's a question of employment in the healthcare field. But don't individuals and businesses have a potential conflict of interest? I mean, why wouldn't a business be trying to do something that would better their business or not better their business?
Chair Morris and Representative Greenlich, I think the difference is not so much that people would have that businesses or consumers have an interest. It's simply that the mission of the exchange is to, in fact, lower costs and improve quality for care for those actual businesses and consumers, and so the consumers' interests and the businesses' interests and the mission of the exchange are not in conflict in that case. They are the same mission, which is to reduce costs while improving quality and improving health.
Yes.
Probably going to say the same thing Senator Bates is going to say, but if you don't have somebody from a different industry or a different take on the board, me as a business owner, you as a business owner, hey, we want it cheaper. So we're going to do everything we can to drive costs down. We might be hurting doctors saying, hey, we'll just cut reimbursement rates to doctors through the exchange and say that they're going to take less. And then pretty soon, they're not going to be at the RVU unit of $68, but they're going to be getting paid the same thing as Medicaid at $28, and nobody gets to see a doctor because they've all left the state. So everybody has a conflict of interest when they sit there.
Chair Morrison and Representative Widener, I think that's a very good point, that a board, when taking a set of actions to its extreme case, there may be consequences that would actually be counter to the goals of that board, which is, in fact, as it's listed in the bill, to lower costs, but by improving quality and overall population health. As you stated, that would be taking this to a severe severe degree and reducing the access to actual providers would clearly be very bad for population health, so that would be a problem. And I think what this gets to is making sure that the board, while made up of people who will ultimately need to be accountable to the overall public and the consumers and the businesses who get their health care through the exchange and purchase it through the exchange, but that there is a robust opportunity for providers, insurance companies, small businesses, consumers, brokers, to have input into the decisions of the exchange through the advisory committees, through and through other opportunities to be engaged in the decisions of this board.
Laura, thank you for this excellent work. I'm looking at the clock, and I'm looking at your paper. Would you like to just hit the high points? Because we have three more people to testify, well, actually four to testify.
Senator Morse, I would be happy to summarize the rest of my testimony and wrap it up. There are a couple of pieces where we'd love for the exchange to clarify the role of the exchange in reducing costs and negotiating for a better deal for consumers and businesses, and have a few suggestions in that area, just adding a little bit more specificity around having the board make determinations and set some criteria and standards for qualified health plans and for carriers, and to take into account in determining that the benefits for the premiums charged and the extent to which the insurance plan and the carrier are adopting payment reforms and delivery system reforms, maybe elements that the board would want to go to. Further detail on the specific standards or the specific criteria we agree is probably left best to the flexibility of the board itself, but a little bit more specificity that actual standards should probably set and criteria themselves be set, I think would be helpful in linking that to the mission again. And then finally, I think the last one I want to just mention is I think there's want to commend the bill in its support of making sure that the exchange is transparent to the public, that its functions are transparent and accountable. We'd recommend, and one of the pieces, for example, that we support is the provision directing the Secretary of State to conduct an annual audit of the exchange and its operations. We'd recommend that the bill specify that that audit should be posted on the state's transparency website, together with information on the exchange's budget, details of spending and revenue, contracts with insurers and outside vendors as well, so that like the state's direct spending, that the spending and the operations of the exchange would be fully transparent both to the public and to lawmakers for further accountability. Thank you.
Thank you. Martin?
Senator Morse, members of the committee and special guests, for the record, my name is Martin Taylor. I'm here with CARE Oregon. I'm the Director of Public Policy and Member Centricity at CARE Oregon. And let me just start by saying, sitting next to Laura, who organizes all of us, and certainly Eileen, who's been more years of service than this, I feel very unworthy in this conversation. I really, they should have been a panel of two, and I should have come up later, but I'll do my best. Let's start with this. The reason we need an exchange is an access question. We have done a good job in society of providing access to care if you're old enough, a relatively good job if you're poor enough or in a special category of disability. And for employed people, many of us get health care. But there's a population that we've left out of this part of our social contract, and this is trying to plug that gap. So why does a Medicaid plan come and testify on a bill that doesn't clearly say there's going to be Medicaid place? Pretty easy. Two-thirds of our members are kids. If you're a working or self-employed or a mom in a small business and you want to have a kid or you're pregnant, getting a little poor to qualify for Medicaid is a pretty good way of getting that cost covered. In other words, there is a relationship between the Medicaid system and how many people we pay for publicly and the lack of insurance if you make just a little bit more money. This is a really smart cost containment strategy, in part because it will allow people to not say, my best personal move is to get a little smaller and have the public pay for my health care. I have an option, a place to go. I have access. We think of this as small business. It's true. But this is bunch of people. Some of them are in small business, some of them are self-employed, some of them just have stories. These are people that we're not giving health care to, and this is the place that we're going to go to try to fix that. Now the question is, when you create this entity, what's its purpose? And I think its purpose is to give that population buying power. That's what they don't have right now. They could theoretically, any of them, get health care. It would just be really expensive because they don't have any buying power. They're individuals or small groups. So they're thrown into this system that tries to calculate their risk and charges them a whole lot more than they can afford. So you basically price them out. This is a way to create groupness for people who aren't by themselves a large enough group and give them buying power. If you're going to give them buying power, give them the buying power that allows them to negotiate health care that's as good as my health care. And the way you negotiate good health care is to have a smart purchaser mentality, to go into this relationship not just as a portal to any health care that someone wants to offer, but as a portal to the best, most affordable health care 350,000 Oregonians can get. Because that's what we want from our employer, and that's what we want from our state if you're in Medicaid, or the federal government if you're Medicare. You want to get the best deal you can. This is the way to use that buying power to get them the best deal. So What are the rules? How do we create attributes for that buying power? And it was a great job explaining those attributes. But there are things like the system needs to be easy to understand, so I know how to use my buying power. It needs to be stable. It needs to be sustainable. There needs to be people there who have enough expertise to make sure I get quality and take advantage of patient-centered primary care and evidence-based medicine. All of those things should be in the thinking and the DNA of a company that's going to try to get the best deal for 350,000 Oregonians. Another part of it is, it's got to have their best interest at heart. So you're creating a public corporation. That's a really good way of going. If you were just doing it as a private company, maybe there would be a profit motivation. If the exchange was going to be an extension of government, maybe it feels too much like a big government taking everything over. But it's not. It's a different entity. It's a public corporation. So the question is, who governs this public corporation? In my mind, this all starts with those 350,000 people you're giving buying power to. The what they get, what they get purchased, should reflect what they need and what they want. It shouldn't reflect what an insurance company wants to sell them or a provider wants to make off of them. And frankly, I'm not sure it should reflect the political agenda of a bunch of political appointees. I think that the whole DNA of this entity should be, it's the idea is that these consumers ought to have as much ability to influence the quality of the products and the price of the products as anybody else. So I think the consumer emphasis and reducing conflicts of interest is actually really, really important. And you know, to your earlier question about, well, how about just driving the price down until it's too little? Yeah, there's a concern. There needs to be expertise on this. But let's also recognize that you've got a whole lot of systems that have been in place a long time, run by healthcare experts, and they're not doing the job right. The system's way too expensive. We don't emphasize quality. We emphasize sick care. How much worse is it really going to be to say, let's have some piece of our DNA as a healthcare industry that's got a consumer mentality and is trying to do the job of getting the best product at the lowest price? I just don't see how this can be worse than the system we've got right now. The last thing I'd suggest is that there's four specific things in this bill that I just want to point out very quickly, and I'll do rapid fire. In page one, you reference the triple aim from IHI. You replaced IHI's experience of care with a simple word called quality. The experience of care is actually a different thing than quality. It's possible to get a good quality product, but for people to not be very satisfied with it, experience of care is all about patient satisfaction, having people believe in the system. So I recommend that change. On page 4, line 13 through 16, you describe very broad set of things that people are supposed to report about their employment and employer. I'm just a little concerned that when people change employers a lot in and out of exchange, it's a hard thing to report in. Kind of wonder how that's going to work. On page 8, line 11, you have a consumer advisory committee, which sounds great, doesn't seem to have any powers or authority. Really kind of want to know what the function is there. And on page 15, line 2, you refer to insurance carriers. In other places in the bill, you refer to them as plans. And on page 19, line 28, they're referred to as insurers. A little consistency there would be helpful, particularly if you are one of those things. That's all.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you very much. We have three more: Rick Bennett, John Mullen, and Arthur Towers.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP Oregon. I will indeed be brief as well. Thursday seemed to be particularly long days after the Wednesday nights that many of us spend together. You know, many people would suggest, well, why is AARP concerned about this? Aren't all your members covered by Medicare? And the reality is that nearly 50% of our members are between the ages of 50 and 64, and having access to affordable health coverage is indeed one of their primary concerns. For that reason, AARP was a very active and strong advocate for the inclusion of insurance exchanges in the new health care law. It is the reason why I'm here with you this afternoon advocating for a strong exchange here in Oregon. AARP believes that the exchange is vital in the efforts to extend health coverage while improving access and affordability for those already in the individual and small group markets. We believe the exchange should ensure that all policy and operational choices are considered through the lenses of the consumer, and the decisions are made based on the consumer's best interest. Now, I've provided you with a one-page summary of our particularly issues and concerns and what we believe would make for a strong exchange. I'm not going to read that to you. I would, though, because, in fact, AARP Oregon, along with Osberg, submitted some amendment recommendations to you, particularly related to governance. I would just make note of a couple of points there related to the fact that we also believe that governing bodies should include strong consumer representation and also provide the opportunity for additional issue-specific working or advisory groups to be created and give ongoing input into the process. And to avoid conflicts of interest, the governing board should not include insurers or health care providers that would be subject to regulation or oversight by the exchange. Now, the other thing in closing, I would just say that, in fact, I understand that you've had a number of agents and brokers here and expressing concerns about how the exchange might impact their livelihood. And certainly, I fully understand how the uncertainty of how this exchange might work. And in fact, there may be a few of those agents or brokers who are members of AARP and would probably disagree with the position that we're taking on this. But what I have to tell you is the overwhelming majority of our members, through phone calls and emails and the surveys we do on a regular basis to our members, have indicated overwhelmingly that access to affordable quality health coverage is a great concern to them. Many of them, and we've seen this certainly the last year or two, the uncertainty of whether, in fact, they'll be able to maintain their employer-based insurance and what happens if that's suddenly gone. What if they want to, one of the key factors in determining whether they retire before they are age 65 is related to their ability to access that health coverage. So, indeed, for those reasons, we would urge you to move forward with a very strong exchange, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Comment? Okay. John.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee and House members, for the record, my name is John Mullen. I work with the Oregon Law Center. And my testimony will be very brief today. I just want to begin by saying that the Oregon Law Center works principally with people at or below 125% of the federal poverty level. And, of course, as health care unfolds and we have the Medicaid expansion up to about 138% of the federal poverty level, the population that we work with in the main will be served. However, there are issues that we are interested in, such as the Medicaid coordination, as Ms. Leibowitz talked about earlier, and also the potential for the changing of the eligibility system. As we look at things like Healthy Kids that does eligibility in a different way, traditional way in which Medicaid eligibility has happened, and now with adding a component, a very important component of creating the exchange, where we have to have very good accessible information for people about making good decisions. Ultimately, our board, as we look at healthcare reform, recognizing that while we're speaking on behalf of low-income people, we recognize that we're going to be strong as a state when we have as many people in the system as possible. So in closing, I would just say that I join with the colleagues. We signed on to the February 25th letter, which you all received, and I'm pleased to have done so, and also pleased to work with colleagues that represent different elements of this discussion, because in many ways we're showing and demonstrating, as we work through all of these complicated issues, that we feel that we're all in this together. Thank you very much.
Arthur?
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Arthur Towers. I'm Political Director for Service Employees, Union Local 503. Chair Morris, members of the committee, guests, thanks for the opportunity to testify. I wanted to start by sharing a secret about our union. I know that being the last witness on the last panel on a 3 o'clock in the afternoon hearing is a good place to share a secret. That secret is that 14,000 of our members do not have employment-based health care. That includes adult foster care providers, home care workers, child care providers. We also have a number of members, about 3,000, who either work in small businesses and nursing homes or for private nonprofits. And we are strongly in support of the creation of an exchange that is owned, operated, and served for the public good. While private companies and insurers and providers are all important partners in the provision of health insurance and quality health care, exchange policies must ensure the public interest is served and the quality, affordable care becomes a reality for more of Oregon's families. I won't belabor a lot of the points that have been covered better than I ever could by the preceding witnesses, but we are also very concerned about the governance issues. We're also concerned that individuals have access to unbiased information about their options. All information, including the web portal, should be designed so that consumers can easily compare plan costs and benefits to determine the best plan for them. Consumers should never have excessive hold times or difficulty accessing services. They should be able to receive timely responses to their questions. And finally, Oregon's exchanges should ensure maximum transparency and clearly define a process for public comment, performance review, and accountability. Again, this should be a consumer-oriented entity, and I think that is going to be what's going to best be able to improve the quality of health care in Oregon and keep costs down. So thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
You did good.
Thank you.
And you were worried about that.
Could I?
Yes.
Thank you.
Description of the green light.
I am surprised of that 14,000 number. How many total members do you have? And do you have a guess of how many of that 14,000 are on Medicaid, on the Oregon Health Plan?
Chair Morris, Representative Greenlick, we have about 45,000 members within SEIU Local 503, another between 7,000 and 8,000 in SEIU Local 49. They're the hospital workers and commercial janitors. Of that 14,000, it's not clear to me how many are on the Oregon Health Plan. We do know that the Oregon Home Care Commission is the the second largest employer when it comes to the number of employees on one form of public assistance or another, and that could be food stamps, it could be other some other sort of public assistance.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Well, thank you.
Thank you.
If there's anyone else that would like to testify, we would entertain that. Hearing none, we're adjourned.
Good work.